facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, everybody, a terrific Tuesday to you. It is December the 13th, 2022. Lots to talk to you about. And you can call in right now, 888-914-9149. Once again, that number to call, dial it right now. Save it. It's one of your favorites. We want to hear from you. 888-914-9149. You can also email the program. Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com is the address. C-A-L-E. At relevantradio.com. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter. Maybe I'll get the blue check mark from Elon Musk. I don't know. But other people, their check marks could be taken away. But you can still find me for now at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account is at Cale Clark Show. You can follow that one as well. Well, speaking of the Cale Clark Show, which is what you're listening to right now, it is a fusion of faith, facts, and fun. And speaking of fusion, as you probably heard, the United States has announced today a breakthrough in nuclear fusion, or some would call it nuclear fusion. But Kenneth Chang, writing for the New York Times, really explained it well in a piece that he wrote this afternoon. I'm just going to quote some of this to you. Scientists studying fusion energy at Lawrence Livermore, sounds like the name of a comedian, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California announced on Tuesday that they had crossed a long-awaited milestone in reproducing the power of the sun in a laboratory. And this, of course, sparked a lot of public excitement, as scientists have for decades talked about how fusion, the nuclear reaction that actually makes the stars shine. If you're wondering why the stars give light, this is why. It's a nuclear fusion. It's a nuclear reaction that makes stars shine, and scientists have always wondered, could this possibly provide a future source of unlimited energy on planet Earth? And so what happened, the announcement that came today, we've had the first fusion reaction in a laboratory. And of course, it is, once again, at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And that was this is actually the first time that a fusion reaction has taken place that produced more energy than it took to get it started. It produced more energy as an output. So this offers a lot of hope, a lot of hope. And there's a quote from a White House science advisor who said this, quote, "This is such a wonderful example of a possibility realized, a scientific milestone achieved, and a road ahead to possibilities for clean energy," end of quote. So basically what's going to happen is if they can get fusion deployed on a large scale, it's going to offer unlimited clean energy. People are concerned about pollution. People are concerned about greenhouse gases, fossil fuels, you know that. Radioactive waste. Okay, now nuclear power. I know people are down on nuclear power, but it still has a lot of great uses. But it does, of course, one of the byproducts is radioactive waste. And how they make power in nuclear power plants, I'm no expert on this by any stretch of the imagination, but I live close to one. There's one actually down the road. And it uses the splitting of uranium to produce energy. Not the case with fusion. So how it works within the sun and the stars is that fusion combines hydrogen atoms into helium, and that produces sunlight and warmth that bathes the planets. So that's your science lesson for today. But in these experimental reactors and labs that are on Earth, such as the, once again, the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, what they do is they use lasers in these labs to try to create fusion and hopefully be able to reproduce it at a large scale as an unlimited source of energy. So in all the experiments they've ever done before, they were never able to get the experiment to produce more energy than it took to get it started. But that all changed on December the 5th. And it was just announced today, but this all happened at 1:03 a.m. on December the 5th. 192 lasers at the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory blasted a small cylinder. It was about the size of a pencil eraser, really tiny, but that contained, that little pencil eraser-sized cylinder had within it a frozen nubin of hydrogen encased in a diamond. I once gave my wife a nubin of hydrogen encased in a diamond. It was a touching Valentine's gift. But anyways, The laser beams went in through the top and the bottom of the cylinder. It vaporized it, and that generated an onslaught of X-rays that compressed a BB-sized fuel pellet of something called deuterium and tritium, which are the heavier forms of hydrogen. This is way more in the weeds that I wanted to get into here. But at the end of the day, in a brief moment lasting less than 100 trillionths of a second, it's too much math. I'm not going to get into this. So the megajoules of energy, forget it. But all you need to know is that this is a huge advancement, and it finally delivered the goal that was promised when they started researching this back in 1997. Wow. So billions have been invested here, and it finally seems to be paying off. But is this are we opening Pandora's box here, or is this something that's really going to change the world for the good? You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. You know, I wonder if Dr. Otto Octavius was involved with this at the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. Now, of course, you know that in Spider-Man 2, which came out in 2004, Otto Octavius, of course, who becomes, I don't want to spoil this for you, but he becomes Dr. Octopus, Doc Ox. He was working on a fusion experiment. As soon as I read about this, it immediately made me think of Spider-Man 2. Remember this famous line? Check this out.
The sun in the palm of my hand.
Yes, the power of the sun in the palm of my hand. That was Alfred Molina playing Otto Octavius / Doc Ock. And he's working on this fusion experiment, and he's got these octopus metal arms that he's using to kind of manipulate things. And of course, they get fused to his body. He becomes evil, and Spider-Man has to take him on. Great movie, by the way. Total sidebar, but Spider-Man 2, when it came out, I think was probably the best superhero movie of all time at that time, and it still holds up really, really well. I'd put it in my top three. I digress, but definitely watch that movie over the holidays if you haven't seen it already. But the power of the sun in the palm of your hand, that's always been the dream when it comes to fusion. Clean, renewable, cheap, limitless electricity for all. Well, somebody who's a little bit skeptical about this is J.D. Flynn. And if you subscribe to The Pillar, Catholic journalism, he wrote about this today. And he said this. He said, don't believe everything you read. He said, we should understand that this is a pretty cool feat, but it doesn't mean that we're only 5 minutes away from a consequence-free production of unending electricity. Far from it. And he's like, okay, we've got a long way to go before this gets from what he calls a party trick to something that you can actually reproduce, commercialize, and maybe this will come quickly, maybe not. I think this is a pretty great advancement. I think, and things move a lot faster in science than they used to. And I think it might get here quicker than we realize, but J.D. Flynn says, really, it's just a paper promise at the moment. But he kind of raises some of the moral problems that might ensue because of fusion energy. He calls it a utopist fantasy that's being peddled. How to bottle the sun, I guess you could say, as Dr. Octavius said, the power of the sun in the palm of your hand. Will this really lead to some sort of a utopia on Earth, fraternity? Liberté, fraternité, like, you know, the French Revolution, equal benefit to all. That's terrible for the church, by the way. Shortcuts to having stewardship over the goods of the earth. We won't have to rely on fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, J.D. Flynn says this. He says, quote, this would effectively be the crowning triumph of the Enlightenment's promise that we can conquer nature, the very sun itself, and usher in a new era of human peace, prosperity, and friendship. Gene Roddenberry waited his whole life in the sanctuary of science, waiting just for that moment, and wrote himself a final frontier in which it came true. Of course, referencing Star Trek for all you Trekkies out there. But he says, narratives like that don't take into account the ubiquity of human sinfulness. End of quote. So he gives the example of he starts talking about what we've been going through over the past 3 years with COVID, right? No matter what you think about the pandemic, no matter what your political leanings are, think about people that you know. He says, think about people that you saw on TV and how they acted. And we all kind of got a dose of our own mortality, that we are not in control. We are not in control, no matter how technologically sophisticated we are. Our control has limits. God is still God, and there's a lot that we don't have agency over. And yeah, interesting. Depending on how you look at it, and obviously, I'm not going to wade into this debate, but the speed with which they produced the COVID vaccines, no matter what your take on those are, that's a pretty amazing scientific achievement. And Trump talked about that, you know, how fast it happened, and that is something. That is something. So, what about this idea that we could make power that really would be on the same level as what powers a star? And J.D. Flynn says, okay, if we're actually able to do this, do you really think it's going to launch well for humanity? And he's not an optimist on this. He thinks you're going to see a lot of vices come into play: greed, self-promotion, self-protection, winners, losers, conspiracy theorists, people who quote-unquote trust the science. It's not going to be pretty. And it's going to be volatile, maybe as volatile as a fusion experiment run by Dr. Octopus. So here's the thing, and he rightly points this out: technical knowledge does not equal wisdom, and it does not equal virtue. And he gives the example, of course, of what happened 77 years ago in Japan with the dropping of the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, splitting atoms. Did it bring about peace? Maybe in the short term. But maybe smooshing atoms together, like what happens with fusion, as Flynn says, maybe that doesn't exactly lead to the salvation of mankind either, not without God's grace. So he says, look, what we really need here is virtue. I'm going to give another quote from his article here. He says, quote, "Christians are not always optimists, but we do have hope. We know that Jesus Christ is the true and lasting savior of the world. Maybe I'm too pessimistic, and nuclear fusion technology is finally just around the corner and just going to be all around the world. It will be distributed with peace and goodwill for all, maybe. But if we expect to use this technology well, as with any technology, it will be because Christ has transformed our hearts and imbued us with virtue," end of quote. I think he's bang on there. I think Flynn is bang on there. We've got to have ethics. We've got to have virtue. And the great danger of the modern age is that we have incredibly powerful technologies that in the hands of the wrong people can lead to unspeakable tragedy. I'm reminded of a quote, and I'm going to reference it here, by Peter Kraft, a friend of the program, that we live in a culture, we live in a society of essentially highly skilled barbarians. The fact of the matter is that our technological know-how has outstripped most people's knowledge and lived out experience of the Catholic faith. And this is dangerous. Now, every age, every successive age in the history of mankind has been the most advanced technological age in the history of mankind. It always is that way. But as the tools get more powerful, we have to ask the question, are we using them wisely? There's a lot of knowledge out there, but not an awful lot of wisdom. And so this is it. And he says, look, Flynn says, the bright light for humanity is not nuclear fusion. The bright light for humanity is Jesus Christ. How important that is, how true that is. And that brings us to St. Lucy. The feast of the day is the feast of St. Lucy. And hey, this show is a fusion, a faith, a powerful fusion, maybe even a nuclear fusion of faith, facts, and fun. We're going to talk about St. Lucy on her feast day, what we can learn about real light and real power in her life on the Cale Clark Show right after this. 888-914-9149. Call in if you want to react. 888-914-9149. It's Cale Clark Show, only right here on Relevant Radio. We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Hey, we talked about the power of fusion. What about the fusion power of faith. Well, that was really on display in the life of today's saint, Saint Lucy. And if you check my Twitter feed, you can follow me at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. I did post a picture that my daughter Michaela drew of St. Lucy. This is way before her feast day. She didn't do it today, but she somehow has become fascinated with St. Lucy. And she got it right. She got it right. She drew this image of St. Lucy, and St. Lucy has, as you know, tradition says that her eyes were torn out. We'll get into that in just a second. So Michaela drew her. Now, usually in paintings, St. Lucy is holding sort of a platter with her eyes on it, but she still has her eyes in her head too, which I'll get into that in a second. So Michaela did that right, except the eyes are in a chalice instead of on a platter. But that's okay. That's okay. Maybe some interesting spiritual insight there. Check out that drawing. If you go to my Twitter feed, you'll see it there. And who really was St. Lucy? Well, I must confess, this is a saint that before Michaela got interested in her, I didn't know too much about her myself. I had to look it up. And of course, I've heard of her, but St. Lucy was born to parents of the nobility in the Roman Empire. And she was born around 283 AD. Now, at this point, of course, the faith is still illegal. She was born in Syracuse, and not Syracuse, New York, home of the Orange Men, but Syracuse, Italy. Syracuse, Italy. And when her father passed away, her mother tried to set up an arranged marriage, as was often the case today and still is the case in many cultures in the world. Arranged marriages, and her mother attempted to arrange a marriage between Lucy and this guy who was a pagan. And Lucy said, I really don't want to do this, Mom. And she really was kind of called to this consecrated life, a life of virginity. She wanted to dedicate herself exclusively to Christ as a virgin. And so her mother is like, well, I really think you should marry this guy. And they went on a pilgrimage because her mother was actually quite ill at the time. She had a hemorrhage. And Lucy and her mom went to the shrine of St. Agatha. Now, St. Agatha, I'll get into this in just a second. St. Agatha, along with St. Lucy, both of them are mentioned in Eucharistic prayer number one. But they went to the shrine of St. Agatha, and they were basically imploring her intercession for a cure for Lucy's mom. And St. Agatha actually appeared to Lucy in a vision or a dream, and she said, look, your prayer will be answered by God. Your mother is going to be healed. And so she was. So she was. And when her mother got better, Lucy said, I got a couple favors for you. I've been interceding for you, St. Agatha. You got your healing. I want you to do a couple things for me. First of all, Mom, I don't want to marry this guy. I know you've gone to a lot of trouble trying to be a matchmaker, setting this up. I don't want to marry this dude. And Lucy also said, can we please share some of our vast wealth, if not all of it, with the poor? And her mother's like, okay, you know, God has healed me. Let's take this thing seriously. Let's do it. So you don't have to marry this guy. You can dedicate yourself to Christ. We're going to give some wealth, if not all of it, to the poor. Now, when this guy, and I don't know what his name was, I'm sure tradition assigns a name to him, but when he heard that Lucy was no longer going to go through with the marriage, and she was going to take her dowry, and instead of giving it to him, we're going to give it to the poor, he got really, really angry. And just the fires of jealous anger, maybe some jealousy towards Christ. He got really consumed by this. And in fact, he outed Lucy, if you will, as a Catholic Christian to the Roman officials. And of course, faith was illegal at that point. Persecutions were in full swing. And Lucy was sentenced to death. So in terms of how she died, there are, again, a lot of legends have grown up around this. I don't know how many of them are based in fact, but it is said that even a team of oxen could not move her from one place to another. She was hooked up to them, and they couldn't move her. A supernatural event. Then they tried to burn her at the stake, but they couldn't get the fire started. And finally, she was martyred with a sword in the year 304 AD. She was only 21 years old. Now, in the Eucharistic prayers of the Mass, there are seven female saints who are invoked. Three of them are in Eucharistic prayer number one, which is known as the Roman Canon. I love that, the Roman Canon. It sounds so cool. Saint Agatha, who appeared to Saint Lucy in the vision, Saint Agnes, and Saint Cecilia. Those three are also virgin martyrs. They were all virgin martyrs. So we do know that it is said of St. Lucy that her eyes were plucked out of her head by her torturers, and this is why she's depicted as holding a plate with her eyes on it. But her eyes are still, you know, in her image. It's not like she, you know, has a skull with no eyes in it. Her eyes are in her head too. Why is that? Why is she depicted that way? Well, it's because faith is really about what we can't see with our physical eyes. The eyes of faith are a gift from God, just as our physical eyesight is a gift from God. And the eyes of faith help us to see beyond the pale, beyond the curtain, the God who is all love, the God who is all beauty and all truth. And it reminds me a lot of Hebrews chapter 11. Now, Hebrews 11 is a great, inspiring chapter of scripture. It's known as the Hall of Fame of Faith, if you will. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. Here's the first couple of verses of Hebrews chapter 11. It says, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for." If you want a good definition of faith, this is pretty good. Well, it's scripture, of course. It's the word of God. "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." Or in some translations, it says the evidence of things not seen. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And another word for faith, I really think it's the same thing as trust. You know, "Jesus, I trust in you," the Divine Mercy, every day on the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Drew prays the chapel with you at 3 p.m. Central. And it's just such one of the highlights of our day here on Relevant Radio, along with the Mass, along with the Rosary. They're like three pillars or tent poles that really kind of hold up everything that we do throughout the day. It's got to be undergirded by prayer. And that's the foundation of what we do at Relevant Radio, as we seek to bring Christ to the world through the media. And so faith is the evidence of things not seen. And it says in verse 2, by faith, the men of old received divine approval. By faith, we understand that the world was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was made out of things which do not appear. So what is seen, the physical world, really has its roots in the unseen world, the reality of God. And I read a really interesting piece on St. Lucy. I happened to come across it as I was doing research. It was at the website Blessed Is She, and Blessed Is She is a really popular website. Really, a lot of Catholic moms and Catholic women read this website, and others too, I guess. And it comes from, of course, Luke 1:45, and that's when Elizabeth says to Mary, this is the visitation, "Blessed is she who has believed that the Lord will fulfill his promises to her." And Sarah Dam was writing on Blessed is She about St. Lucy and how it's kind of interesting that her feast day happens really in the darkness of winter. As the days are getting shorter, we're getting closer and closer and closer to the winter solstice. And she really talks about how there's so many scriptures that talk about how God has prepared the world for the light and the power of Christ. And 1 Corinthians 2:9 is a really good example. And on our Faith Explained program on Relevant Radio, which is the other show I host on the network every day, we did a series that is called Saints in Sin City, and we kind of played a sample from that the other day. We kind of had a sample pack where we played an episode from some of the recent series we've done, and that was one of them, Saints in Sin City. And it's all about the first letter of St. Paul to the city of Corinth, which was a city much like a modern-day city in North America, full of immorality, secularity, yet not immune to the hope of the gospel. There's still hope. And this is what St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2:9. He says, "What no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the human heart conceived, what God has prepared for those who love him." So no eye has seen, no ear has heard, nor has it even entered into the human heart, what God has prepared for those who love him. And I can't wait to see what that is and to experience what that is, please God. And this idea of the eyes and also the eyes of faith. And we talk about that on the feast day of St. Lucy. We could think about the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, verses 22 and 23. Jesus says, the eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. In the book of Sirach, chapter 3, verse 25, it says, without eyes, there is no light. Without knowledge, there is no wisdom. And by the way, one of the reasons why this saying, the eyes, the lamp of the body, or without eyes, there is no light, the ancients used to think that light came from the eye into the outside world. And that's, you know, sometimes, have you ever seen the eyes of like an animal in the nighttime, where you shine your headlights on, I don't know, like a raccoon or a coyote, or you see the eyes of a dog in the street light, and it's kind of this, they kind of shine in this weird way. And so the ancients used to think that, oh, well, the light must come from the eye. And we know that's not the case, but the point of the matter is that we're talking about spiritual light here, supernatural light. And so the name Lucy, by the way, the name Lucy comes from the Latin word lux, which means light, like lux mundi, right? The light of the world. And this is what it was, what St. Lucy's life is really all about. It was a brutal time for the church, a brutal time in history. There's a lot of persecutions, as the church is persecuted throughout the world, more so in other lands than in North America. We are persecuted too in different ways. But this, her light is such a shining example of being able to reflect the light of Jesus Christ. Jesus is the true light of the world. And she decided to live for Christ, and her life was at stake because of that. She could have gone along with the plans of her mom at the time to just, you know, enter into this marriage. Not that marriage is bad or anything like that. It's a gift of God, but that wasn't what God wanted from her. That wasn't her vocation. And so she really kind of reflects that light of Christ, like the moon reflects the light of the sun. That's what we're called to do. And Sarah Dam wrote today in this article that Lucy's feast day is fittingly situated in the midst of the darkest, coldest time of the year. During the Advent season, we're immersed in darkness. We're near the winter solstice, and it's like one of my favorite hymns of all time, In the Bleak Midwinter. Let's check out a clip. This is, by the way, this is from David Phelps, gospel singer. Do yourself a favor, look this up on YouTube. It's a great rendition of In the Bleak Midwinter. Just want to play a little bit of it for you. Okay, well, we'll do that in a second. Jim's just getting the clip ready. But as we set that up for you, I just want to say that as we're leading up to celebrating the birth of the Messiah, there was an awful lot of darkness in Jesus' world as well, in the world at the time of Lucy. It's always the case. It's always the case that there's a spiritual darkness all around us. St. Paul says that part of our mandate as Catholic Christians is to shine like stars in the midst of this darkness, this moral depravity that's all around us. And we talked about fusion, nuclear fusion earlier, and that's what powers the light of the stars. Well, we need that light of Christ to really power our inner life so we can reflect that light to others. The Gospel of John says that the life that was in Jesus was the light of all people, John chapter 1. Verse 4. So this is all throughout the Advent season. We're gonna see a lot of scriptures throughout Advent as we go to Mass, as we really think about this in these last few days of Advent. In Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them the light has shone. Isaiah 60, verse 2, darkness shall cover the earth, thick darkness the peoples, but the Lord will arise upon you. His glory will appear over you. Luke chapter 1, verses 78 and 79. By the tender mercy of our God, the dawn from on high will break upon us to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. And John 1, 5 says, the light shines in the darkness. The darkness did not overcome it, or the darkness has not understood it. And so, as we think about this, as we think about the Advent wreath, as we light those candles, we think about St. Lucy and how she reflects that light of the world. And she really shows us how to be a witness, how to bring light to those dark places. And so hopefully we can be that to others as well. And just as we go to break, I'm gonna ask producer Jim just to play us out with that song, In the Bleak Midwinter by David Phelps. Check this out. May it be a prayer for you.
the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. Earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow had fallen, snow, snow, snow.
The Relevant Radio studio line is sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters Flexible Premium Life Insurance. For less than $12 a month, a 40-year-old can get $500,000 of coverage. Go to relevantradio.com/forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back to the program on this, what day is it? It's Tuesday. And they all just kind of blend into one, don't they? Tuesday, December the 13th, it's the Feast of St. Lucy. We talked about that. We talked about nuclear fusion. Man, we've kind of covered the gamut. Faith, facts, and fun. We say, okay, the fusion was facts. St. Lucy was faith. Where's the fun? I'll give you a little bit of fun here. I want to share with you a lighthearted moment that occurred last week at our Relevant Radio Christmas party. I'm going to make you feel like you were there. I want to let you in on a little secret. There is a very controversial message board in the offices of Relevant Radio in the Chicago area. It's called the Pets of Relevant Radio. Now, some employees, and I'm not going to say who, want this thing taken down. They think it's ridiculous. I'm 100% in favor of it. I own two dogs, and sometimes you might even hear them barking during the show. We try to keep them quiet as best as possible. My wife is, you know, trying to placate them so they don't, take over the show here. But I have a black lab named Poppy, and I have a little tiny terrier. She's a new dog named Cookie. Anyways, two very different, one big, one small. So I got to send some pictures in for the Pets of Relevant Radio board. And so, you know, some people who are pet lovers have shared images of their animals on this board, and they gather. It's right by the coffee machine. So everybody kind of gathers around, talks about the pets. And for months, there was a picture of someone's pet pig. And this pig allegedly belonged to Kevin Conroy, who is involved in production at Relevant Radio. He works with the Merry Beggars. He's really part of the entertainment division of Relevant Radio, the Merry Beggars. And you know, of course, about their fine programming, such as On the Night Train, Christmas Carol. You can access that, of course, through the Relevant Radio app anytime you want. It's all great stuff. And Kevin allegedly had this pet pig. And it was like, well, is this for real? And he's like, oh, yeah, it's totally real. And there was a rumor that his pet pig would actually be making an appearance at the Christmas party. So at a certain point in the festivities, Kevin got up and he said, a lot of you guys have been asking about this. You've seen the picture of my pet pig on the Pets of Relevant Radio board. Well, Matt Beardsley, and Matthew, of course, is one of the engineers here at Relevant Radio, is a great, great guy. He was actually wearing he was in full regalia. He was wearing his kilt. He's a true Scotsman. He was wearing his kilt that night at the party. And, oh, he's Irish, apparently. Okay, so he's not a true Scotsman. Okay, thank you, Producer Jim, for disabusing me of that notion. He just whispered that in my ear. Sorry, Matt. Sorry, Beardsley. And so Kevin Conroy's like, okay, Matthew Beardsley is coming in right now with my pet pig. And so Matt came in his kilt, and he was carrying this blanket, and it was so cute, and everyone's like oohing and aahing. He gets up to the front. He's like, hey, do you want to see the pet pig? And everyone's like, yeah, let's see it. So he pulls out from this blanket a package of bacon. All right, that was a really, they were really playing the long game with that joke. I mean, that picture had been up for months about the pet pig. So well played, guys, well played. I talk about piggy in a blanket. There you have it. So I guess they fried it up the next morning. But these are the kinds of festivities that we have when we get together at Relevant Radio. I know it was an absolutely wonderful time. Well, the pig isn't real, and some of you guys don't like things that are real when it comes to Christmas trees. I want to ask you this question, 888-914-9149. Are you an artificial tree guy or gal? Are you an artificial tree family, or do you prefer real, honest-to-goodness Christmas trees? Despite the fact that needles get all over the place, you got to water the thing, there could be a fire, hopefully not, but are you an artificial tree person for Christmas or a real tree, and why? 888-914-9149. Please call in. I need to know what you think about this. And speaking of artificial versus real, this is kind of interesting. Now, I was watching Monday Night Football last night, as you're calling in, 888-914-9149, a game between the Patriots and the Cardinals. The Patriots kept their playoff hopes alive, beat the Cardinals. And I don't know, stadium names change all the time now, and I don't know whether it's still called the University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale, Arizona, where the Cardinals are based. What's really interesting about the field, now this is a domed stadium in Arizona, but there have been Super Bowls played there before, famously one involving the Patriots. Their undefeated season came to an end in the University of Phoenix Stadium at the hands of Eli Manning and David Tyree, the helmet catch, all that stuff. And I love watching the Manning cast, by the way, Peyton and Eli. I love watching their Monday Night Football commentary if it's on. You know, thank you. Our crack researcher, Patrick Alog, tells me that it's called State Farm Stadium in Arizona now. So, okay, Jake from State Farm is roaming the halls. At any rate, what's really cool, this is amazing technology, at State Farm Stadium. So, University of Phoenix got some extra play there. They didn't have to pay for that advertising I just gave them. It's not called that anymore. It's State Farm Stadium. But the real grass field, this is really cool. This is something that you think of as a kid, you know, just, you know, dreaming up projects. It's real grass, but it's a dome stadium. So how do they make the grass grow? They pull it out. It's like on a tray. And they actually, with mechanized systems, they move the field outside. It slides out, and there it gets natural sunlight. They grow the grass outside, and then they roll it back in, and they play the game. What an ingenious concept. I love this. And I don't know what you think about real Christmas trees or artificial Christmas trees, and tell me which one you prefer, 888-914-9149. It's a burning question. I really want to know. But when it comes to turf, when it comes to grass, hey, if you're an athlete, you definitely prefer real grass. And By the way, there's a serious side to this. Not only does real grass keep you more injury-free, but there is a potential very toxic health risk from some of these artificial turf fields. And this isn't just affecting professional athletes. Some of you guys out there have kids who play soccer. Maybe you play soccer, maybe you're a young person, or you're playing youth football, and you play on an artificial field, somewhat like the ones they use in the pros, field turf. And you ever notice, you see this on TV all the time. If you're watching a soccer game, the goalie dives to make a save. Or in football, they tap their toes, you know, toe drag swag, as they say, to get a catch and bounce. And you see these black pellets popping up from the turf and kind of spraying through the air. These are actually little bits of rubber crumbs, and they come from recycled tires, car tires, truck tires. And what they do is they put this rubber crumb material in the field, in the artificial turf, to try to make it softer. But a lot of people think this is actually a very serious potential carcinogen. Now, we don't have the definitive link on this yet, but lots of news articles. I saw a little documentary clip about this, and it really kind of shocked me. I had never heard of this, but it's just something to be aware of. And again, there's been no link proven yet. It's only anecdotal evidence so far, but there are some potential links between the rubber crumbs that are in artificial turf and cancer rates, especially among soccer players, specifically goalies. Now, why goalies? Well, Washington State University soccer coach Amy Griffin raised these concerns when she noticed that there were a lot of young soccer goalies that she knew of who played and maybe she coached, and they were winding up in cancer clinics. She's like, what's going on here? These are otherwise perfectly healthy young people. They're athletic. They're in good shape. And they're winding up in cancer wards. And a lot of them happen to be goalies. Why is this? And She's coached for about 27 years, and she'd never heard anything about this in the first 15 years of her career. And then all of a sudden, she reported this to NBC News, that there's this stream of kids coming down with all these cancers. And it's always blood cancers as well. And she found 38 soccer players who had been diagnosed with cancer. 34 of them were goalies. Julie Foudy, now you might remember her from the Women's World Cup team, former U.S. national team captain. She's now an ESPN journalist. She made a documentary about this. And so far, the list has grown from 38 that were found by the Washington coach to now it's more than 187 young athletes with cancer. More than half of them are soccer goalies, and most of them have lymphoma. So again, they haven't proved a definitive link yet. But why is this happening? Well, these little crumb rubber pellets, they pop out of the turf, and goalies are always diving to make a save. And what happens is they pop up, and sometimes they get into your cuts in your skin, or sometimes it gets in your mouth because, I don't know, it just happens. And you wind up ingesting them somehow. There was this kid, I read the story about a kid, a young player, who woke up after a soccer game. He was rubbing his eyes. His eyes were really irritated. He had some of these rubber crumb pellets in his eyes. So is this harmful? I think there needs to be a lot more studies on this. These off gases emitted by these rubber pellets maybe potentially causing cancer in young people. So obviously there's a lot of legalities at stake. There's a lot of legal exposure here for some of these companies. But a lot of communities are tearing out these field turf fields. They're easier to maintain. You can do a lot of different things on them. Big professional stadiums love to have them because you can roll them out and have a concert and not really worry about damaging a field of play for another event. But there's a potential cancer link. I'm not saying it's established yet, but this looks pretty bad. It looks pretty bad so far, but I don't know. This is not legal advice, nor is it medical advice, but just something to keep an eye on. But there's a story in The Athletic it was an interview with Nick Bosa from the San Francisco 49ers. And he says, like, if you're a professional athlete, if you have a choice when you become a free agent, you're much more likely, all things being equal, to go to a city, go to a team that has a natural grass turf field, because the injury factor, you get hurt way less on natural grass. Anyways, so we'll have to save that discussion for another time. But a lot of you guys are calling in about the artificial versus real Christmas tree question. Let's go to Roger in Rancho Cucamonga, California. Roger, which one do you like?
Well, I prefer a real Christmas tree, but I'm allergic to the pine, and I found out years ago that it was making me, by the time Christmas would come around, I'd be so sick. So we figured it out that I have a bad allergy, to the pine. And actually, I shared that with my brother, and he lives in Ohio, and he actually ended up selling his house because he has pine trees all around his house, and he said he was severely allergic to the pine. So we buy a Christmas wreath, like at Costco or somewhere, a real one, and put it on the outside of the door because my wife likes to smell the real pine. But for that reason, we don't buy a real one.
And a lot of people, I never thought about that, have pine allergies. Roger, thank you for calling in, and thanks for listening to the program out in Rancho Cucamonga, California, which is one of the funnest names of any town in the world. And pine allergies. Wow, that's a good reason not to have a real one. Let's go to Nicole in Malone, New York. Hi, Nicole.
Hello. I travel to the Adirondack Mountains every day to and from work, so I definitely am all about the real Christmas tree. We've had one in our house and grew up having a real Christmas tree every single year.
So you cut down one.
So we've done that, but mostly it's going to the local.
Okay.
The tree farm out in the country and pick one out and bring it in, try and make sure you can get it into the tree holder just right. And I've only had one year. We had four chairs trying to hold up the tree in the middle of the room and just one bad experience, but we made do the presents still get underneath the tree.
there you go.
No, Jesus is real, so we should have real Christmas trees.
And I think I like that. Jesus is real. We should have a real tree. But I think a lot of people, the childhood memories really come into play, especially with the real trees. Like, this is what we did growing up. It's great family bonding with your siblings, with your parents, and that those memories, you want to kind of recapture those with your own family. And I think that's a big thing I find with people who love the real trees. So, hey, Nicole, thank you very much for calling in. And yeah, the beautiful Adirondacks in New York State. Mm, amazing. Let's go. Hey, we've been to California. We've been to New York State. Let's go down to San Antonio, Texas. David is on the line. Hi, David.
Hi. I'm pretty much on our official tree. It's more of a tradition, you know. We've had them, and I just hate buying one that's been chopped down and then having to dispose of it, you know.
Yeah, well, that's something, yeah, that's never really hit me before, that a lot of people say, well, you know, you have to cut down a tree, and obviously, hopefully you plant another one where one is cut down, but a lot of people might, for environmental reasons, not want to have a real tree. And yeah, that's a really great point, David. And that's kind of a tradition in a lot of families. Just, hey, the artificial tree is our tradition. And obviously there are real concerns with fire and mess and all kinds of things that come into play for those who go with the artificial trees. In my family, we've done both. Like growing up, we've had artificial trees, but we went through a period where we did have a real tree for several years growing up. And I must confess, I personally preferred the real tree, but it was a lot to deal with. I remember all the pine needles getting all over the place and sap and everything. And yes, I'm sappy enough as it is, that's for sure. Well, thanks for that. Let's go now to Mike in Cicero, Illinois. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
I am good. How are you doing?
Good. You know, as a kid, I grew up and we always had a real tree. And then after I got married, we decided to get a fake tree. So we had the artificial tree for a couple of years. But this year we decided to go with a real tree. And it just brings back the memories, you know, of being a kid. And I just love the smell of that pine in the house. Oh, yeah. And just really nice.
It is great, isn't it? I mean, you get to use all the senses there, don't you? You know, and yeah, the smell of a fresh pine tree—you really, really can't beat it. Well, Patrick Alog, who's taking calls, he wanted you to know that he is a fake tree guy all the way. He's all about the fakeness, Patrick. And I'm only kidding, Patrick. But he says it's cheaper. You can use it year after year after year. Jim, producer Jim, how about you?
Hey, I like the real tree all the way. And my kids, if they're listening, they're going to be like, Dad, when are we going to get the tree? They think they're going to run out of trees.
Yeah, they're going to run out of trees. Get the tree, Dad. Come on, man. You're into the third week of Advent already. Come on. Get it together, producer Jim. No. You're a real dude, man. You're all about the realness, keeping it real. And so I'm not surprised that you want to have a legit real tree. But hey, much respect to the artificial tree people out there. We've got one right now, and you really can't go wrong either way. The important thing is to celebrate Christmas itself. And one other note from producer Jim that he just passed my way. He wanted you to know that the name of the pig, the alleged pig, at the Relevant Radio Christmas party was, in fact, Bubbles. Bubbles the pig, who's not really either, apparently. So, pets of Relevant Radio, he's not really one of them, but hope you had fun listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio today. I'm Cale. Jim produced. Patrick Alog took your phone calls. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.